Good evening, gentlemen. We're beginning Parashat Vayeshev. Who runs the show? Are we all puppets?
Yeah.
Is everything strings? Can we do anything in this world? The Parashiyot we are about to learn this week, next week, following week, are going to drive home a point about who really runs the show. And we have to remember the balance between our responsibility to do Hishtadlut and our recognition that our Hishtadlut, though it be a necessary evil in this world, is not what will ultimately define the outcome. Hashem says, without it, it won't work. But it, in and of itself, is not the only factor that will define what the outcome will be. Rachem Hashem Elokeinu al Yisrael Amecher. We say in benching, Hashem, please have mercy over Israel. Please have mercy over Jerusalem, your city, Zion, the kingdom of David, and the great house that your name was called upon it. Our omnipotent God, our Father, our Shepherd, our Sustainer, the one who feeds us, please, Parneseinu, Chalkeleinu, give us sustenance, Vehalvicheinu, and give us breath. Vehalvicheinu, we ask for revach. In quite a few places in our prayer, we ask for revach. Vehalvach lanu Hashem Elokeinu mikol tzaroteinu. And please, Hashem, give us breathing space. Give us some breath from all our afflictions. We ask Hashem, please, we should only need your hand, which is hamele'ah, full, hapetucha, open, hakedosha, holy, veharchava, and wide. Yaakov Avinu has been through a lot. Yaakov Avinu has just had 22 years on the run. Never knows when Esav might show up in Haran, might catch up with him. He's been swindled out of his wife. He's had to contend with his father-in-law, swindling him, trying to take his money. Internal politics between his wives. One wife dies en route. The other wife dies. The wife he wants to go with is taken from him by one of his children. He has a son that's named Ben Oni, son of my sorrow. He comes back to the land of Israel. He's faced with a brother that wants to kill him. He makes it out of there. He finds a city that kidnaps his daughter. And then he has all the surrounding cities ready to kill him. And he sees Esav prosper. And he knows that this is just the beginning. There's still a debt waiting there to be collected. There's still a promise. Yadoa teda ki ger yezarecha be'eretz lo lahem ba'avadum le'inu otam 400 shana. There's still 400 years of servitude waiting for him. And Yaakov Avinu wants to take a breath. Now Yaakov Avinu is an old man. He got married old. And Yaakov Avinu finally makes it back home to his dad's place. He's back by Yitzchak. And if life's been difficult until now, as usually happens in this world, it moves one notch higher. You guys ever drive shift? You know, yeah. You notch things up. That's life. Just when you think you've made it, things are going smoothly, that's when you notch it up. So we don't do it to ourselves. We daven Hashem, don't do it to us. We say, please don't bring us to Al Tevienu Lo De Nisayon. Don't bring us to a situation of tests. But God put us in this world, and He didn't put us on treetops with bananas, but He put us here walking on two, looking straight ahead with our heads held high, and a responsibility to move upward. So in order to move upward, we have to contend with things. So Yaakov is situated in the land of Canaan, and he has a son, Yosef, who's orphaned from his mother. And this child is the one, Elanah Razeit Palalti, that's the one he really wanted. Among all his children, that's the wife he wanted. And Yaakov errs. I'm not one to say Yaakov errs, but Chazal tells Yaakov erred. And Yaakov's recognition that Yosef has tremendous potential and that he's brilliant supports his internal feelings that Yaakov, that his son Yosef is special. And when he makes a robe for his other children, he makes Yosef's that on the sleeve, the pasyad, where it hits his arm, there's one little strip that's different. Ketonet pasim has two marks by the arms, by the pasyad, by the palm of the hand. But you know what? When everyone gets a beige suit, and one kid gets a beige suit with a little red stripe around it, so even though he's the little one, and he's 17, and he's orphaned, and they're all bigger than him, they're 18, they're 19, they're 20, they're 21, they're 22, but they're not too pleased. So enmity develops. There's hatred. And now this little one, 17 years old, he has a dream. And he sees it as prophecy. And he comes to the brothers, and he knows what's going on, but he has a responsibility. He was given prophecy. He tells them, listen, I had a dream. We're all gathering bundles, and my bundle stood up, and your bundles surrounded my bundle, and they all bowed. And the brothers ask him, you think we're going to appoint you as our king, or you think you're going to take it by force? What do you think? Then they hate him even more. And he has another dream, and he tells them again. He has a dream about the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, and they're all bowing to him. And when he tells his father knows what's brewing. So his father asks him, well, you think me and your mother will come bow to you? And the brothers are still jealous. And Yaakov says, wait a second. Between me and God, I had a hidden name, Shemesh. Who told him my name is Shemesh? How do you know I'm represented by the sun? Vayizrach lo ha-shemesh ve-hu tzolea al yerecho. So according to Chazal, Shemesh over there is Yaakov. The brothers go out to Shechem. Now, let's remember, what happened last time they were in Shechem? They wiped out the city, and the neighboring cities got together to try and annihilate Yaakov and his sons. So now they have to go graze their sheep, and they have no better place than Shechem. So they go out to Shechem, and Yaakov gets worried, and he tells Yosef, I want you to go see how your brothers are doing, bring them back. And Yosef goes, and they're not there. And he meets the man. Who is the man? We'll discuss who the man is. And the man asks him, approaches him and asks him, what do you want? And he says, I want my brothers. He doesn't tell him who he is. He doesn't tell him who his brothers are. Suddenly the man is supposed to know what we're talking about. Can you please tell me where they are grazing the sheep? And the man says, they've traveled from here. I heard him saying they're going to Dothan. And Yosef went after his brothers and he finds them in Dothan. And from a distance they see him and they think, let's do him in. And they start saying, you know, there's the dreamer coming. Let's kill him. We'll put him in one of these pits. We'll say a wild animal ate him. And let's see what really happens with his dreams. And Reuven hears it. And Reuven says, no. Al techetu vayeled. Don't sin against the child. They don't want to listen. And Reuven sees that whatever he does doesn't work. So he says, no. You can't be murderers. You can't spill his blood. You want to kill him, at least do it in a roundabout way. There's a difference between someone who kills first degree murder and second degree murder. You want to kill him? Put him in the pit, let him starve to death. Don't you spill his blood. And Reuven's thinking, I'm going to take him at night and bring him back home. They sit down to eat. When Yosef comes to them, they undress him, they take off his ketonet pasim, and they throw him naked into the pit. They sit down to eat.
Not even his undergarments.
So it seems like, and they see some Yishmaelim coming from the murderous area of Gilad, and they must be wealthy. They're carrying all kinds of perfumes. They're merchants going to Egypt. And Yehuda tells the brothers, you know, we're going to walk away without money if we just let him die here. And this isn't a fitting revenge. He kept saying he's going to be king. If we want to do him in, so what do we gain if he's just buried? The real gain, the real way to finish this off is to put him at the bottom. Then we'll be okay. These people, they come from way up north. They're going to way down south to Egypt. No, 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 the difference. Let's sell him to them, and he'll be a slave. And then we'll really pay him back for the way he was talking to us until now. So Yehuda also really saved Yosef's life. Yehuda tells him, you know, he's our brother. And they listen. So the merchants come, they take Yosef out, they sell him for a bunch of shoes, and Yosef's taken down to Egypt. Reuven comes back to the pit. Where was he? So we'll have to discuss that. Reuven comes back and he sees Yosef isn't there. And he tears his clothing, he comes to the brothers and he says, the kid's gone, how am I coming back to dead? And they take Yosef's ktones, they slaughter a goat, they dip his ktones in blood, and they pierce it with holes as though teeth have gone through it. And they bring it to their father and they say, we found this. Do you recognize it? Is it your son's garment? And he sees it and he says, yes, it's the garment of my son. A wild animal. Yehuda Ze'ev Yitro. Naphtali Ayala Shlucha. My sons have been compared to all kinds of wild animals. A wild animal has eaten him. And he tears his clothing and he starts mourning. And his children, his daughters-in-law, his granddaughters, everyone tries to comfort him and he refuses. He says, that's it. I'm going to mourn the rest of my life. And Yosef is sold down in Egypt. He's bought by a man named Potiphar. And in Egypt, when you buy a handsome young man, so you might use him for all kinds of things, and then you might use him for something else. Mm. And Potiphar has that something else in mind. And we'll discuss that later. So he's in the chief executioner's home. He's in Potiphar's home. The brothers look to Yehuda and they say, look at our father. Look at what you made us do. You could have stopped all this. You said to sell him. We listened to you. If you would have said, let's bring him back home, we would have listened to you. And they demote Yehuda from his position of leadership. Yehuda goes and marries a woman. He has three children. When these children are very young, he marries them off. They're 9, 7. They're very young. He marries them off to a fine woman named Tamar. They're young, and they think, we don't want to lose her beauty. So Er ensures that she doesn't get pregnant. And God says, that's not what I put you down on this earth for, and has Er die. Onan recognizes that the children he has in heaven, they go after his brother. So Onan does the same thing as his brother, and he also dies. And Yehuda sees two sons dying. He tells Tamar, look, let's wait till the next one grows up. And Yehuda thinks, my two sons sinned because they were young. I got to wait till Shelah is substantially older before I give him over to Tamar. So Tamar waits, and she sees that Shelah, the little one, reaches the same age as the first two, and Yehuda isn't giving him over. Now Yehuda knows he's not planning on giving him over at this age because he knows that's what messed up the first two. He says he's got to be more mature, he's got to be old enough that I can explain to him, son, this is what marriage is about. You got to have kids, you got to build a family, and Yehuda's not about to give him over when he's this young and he might just do what he wants. So Yehuda's waiting, and Tamar sees he's waiting, and Tamar says, okay, I need to have children from this man. I want to be a part of the kingdom of the Jewish people. And so Tamar gets dressed up. And we all know the rest of the story. Tamar manages to seduce Yehuda without Yehuda knowing it's her. She takes signs from him and he promises to send her a young goat. Remember the last time he was dealing with young goats? And when he tries to send it, no one knows where she is. And then Yehuda has nothing to do. He finds out she becomes pregnant. And he says, okay, she gets a death penalty, she gets burnt to death. Where does it say that? Where did you get that one from? Why did she get burnt to death? So we'll have to discuss that when we review. Yeah? Oh, that's a great question. Okay, but now we're just doing a quick overview. We're taking too much time as it is. So when we review it, we'll have to discuss that. We'll see. So she says, okay, you're going to give me the death penalty. Send this package over to Yehuda and tell him that the man who owns these, he's the one that fathered these children. And Yehuda sees it and she says, you know what, she's a tzaddikus and I did wrong. And Yehuda says, but we won't continue this marriage. And she gives birth to twins, Peretz and Zarach, the famous story. He sticks out his hand, they put on a ribbon, and then the next one comes out. And Yosef's down in Egypt. And he's very successful. And because he's so successful, he goes up the ladder. And eventually he becomes manager of the house. And when he's manager of the house, so he gets everything he wants but the master's wife. And Yosef sees things are going good, so he starts looking after his looks again. And he looks after his looks, so his master's wife also notices his looks. And she tries to seduce him. And he refuses. And as much as she tries, he refuses. Until finally one day she sees there's no one around and she tries to take him forcibly. And she's holding onto his clothing, and he sees that he can't trust himself to be able to contain himself. So he runs out, and he can't run out. She's holding his clothing, so he runs out and leaves the clothing in her hand. Okay. And in those days, you used to wear a robe. So if you leave your robe in someone's hand and you run out, so he's got the clothing and you've got none. So Yosef is standing outside in the center of town, and she finds herself with his robe in her hand. Now that doesn't look too good. So she starts yelling and says, look what happened here. What a servant. He came here. This is what my master wanted. That's what he brought him here for. My master's been castrated for quite a while. Ever since we brought this guy here, he's been castrated. I guess something happened to him, so that's why he brought him. And when at night he's with his wife, Potiphar, so she tells him, you know, all these intimate things you're doing, he did to me too. Everything he starts doing, she starts telling him, he did that too. And she knows how to rile him up, and when she does that, he sees he can't do anything, and he puts Yosef in jail. But he puts him in the Renaissance of jail is a very good place. And again, Yosef works his way up the ladder. He's in a jail for political asylum, a political jail. And the parasha ends with the baker and the winemaker having dreams. And Yosef tells them the solution of their dreams, that the baker, in 3 days, the baker will be put to death and the winemaker will be reinstated. And he begs the winemaker to remember him when he gets out of jail. And now let's review with a little bit more depth. If all I was going to do was tell you the translation, you wouldn't need me, right? So I got to tell you things that doesn't say there. What I said stems from a Gemara in Shabbos that says, "Bishvil mishkal shnei sela'im meilat," that for a small weight of fine thread that Yaakov gave Yosef differently than the brothers, we all ended up in Egypt. So the commentaries ask, that amount of thread doesn't make a colorful clothing. So one of the possible answers that's given is that the whole garment wasn't different than the brothers. It was only one strip that was different, and that's why it was called Ktonet Pasim, Al Pasayat. So the Gemara is in Shabbos, and you could also see it in the Daskin and the Baleatosis on the Pasuk, on Ktonis Pasim. It's brought over there as well. Okay. Let's begin the parsha. I had the good fortune of being engaged to a conversation by an Arab yesterday. And the guy was claiming that they have a right to this land and we don't. So I listened politely, and one of the things he kept saying was, and if you want to go all the way back, so go back to Avram. So I said, okay, let's go back to Avram. So he said, Avram had two sons. So I said, yeah, one from the maid and one from the wife. And he wasn't too happy.
Yeah, she was a concubine. She was
when it comes to Ishmael, if I told him, look, the difference between me and you is that you agree with me that the Torah is God's book. And I don't agree with you that the Quran is God's book. So if you're going to agree with me that the Torah is God's book, well then in the Torah it says that Ishmael was not the chosen son. It says it very clearly. So if we're working off of this basis, you have to explain to me, if we will go back to Abraham, why you feel you have a right to the land. With Ishmael, we don't have an issue as far as we're concerned. It's clear cut from the Torah that he doesn't have a right to the land. But when it comes to Esav and Yaakov both had the same mother and the same father. And there would be room to say that Esav could walk in and say, his offsprings could say, we want a part of the land. We have the same father and the same mother. So the Torah makes a point of telling us in last week's parasha that Esav went and sat in Mount Seir. He was Yoshev. He settled down. And he had kings. He didn't fulfill the prophecy which God told Avram, your children will be Gerim. They will be strangers for 400 years and then I will give them this land. And our parasha begins by telling us how Yaakov was doing the same thing. His father and his grandfather, they all sat in Canaan as strangers. They didn't make their own government. They didn't have their own kings. They sat here as strangers, and that's what Yaakov did. And that's how our parsha is picking up where last week's parsha left off, telling us, take note, that Yaakov is continuing the fulfillment of God's prophecy that we will be strangers in the land, we will be Gerim, and then after a certain number of generations, we'll come back and take the land of Israel. Not only that, it says that he had a kingdom. It says that he inhabited it and had a kingdom. Which word there is, Shon Mar Medayik, I don't remember. We have to see. There is that term used. I'm not sure if it's the Pasuk Vayeshev Esav Behar Seir. I don't remember. If we say that's the term, then we have to say one of two things. Either that's why the Pasuk says, Vayeshev Yaakov, the Eretz Megurei Aviv, that Yaakov sat in the way his father was in the land as a Megurei Aviv. Or we can say, and this is a pshat that Rabbi Feinstein offered once, that Yaakov erred over here. Bikesh Yaakov Leishev V'Shalva. Yaakov said, let me settle down, let me have peace. I've suffered throughout my life, now it's time to settle down. And God said, wait, oh, if you're going to settle down, then this can't count as part of the 400 years. So that's why God made all the trouble with Yosef. And God said, okay, if that's what's happening, if you're not going to be like your father and grandfather to be a wanderer and not settle down, if you want to settle down, then I can't let you do that. The Pasuk now tells us an introduction to the rest of the Torah. Eile toldot Yaakov. From now on are the happenings of Yaakov. We ended last week's parsha telling us how Esav made it to the land, to his settling. Now the Torah tells us, and now for the rest of this work, for the rest of the Torah, there's going to be a description of how Yaakov evolved until finally he made it back as a people to settle in the land of Israel. So this parsha is really introducing the rest of the Torah. Yosef is called a Na'ar. And Yosef is 17 years old. Na'ar usually means a lad who's 13. Or less. So the word Na'ar can also mean a young one that's looked at fondly as being the young one. We find Yoshua bin Nun is 110 years old and he's called Na'ar Lo Yamish Mitoch HaOel. He's the Moshe's lad. Because the relationship was a relationship that was like with a Na'ar. The relationship was like a senior to a minor. But it doesn't necessarily reflect the age. There are things which we do that if someone would come to us and say, why'd you do that? We can say, I can tell you why I did that. He asked me why I ate, because I was hungry. I needed to eat. He asked me why I slept, because I was tired. But then there are things which we do, which if someone comes and asks us, why'd you do that? We're going to have a hard time answering them. And those are the things that really revolve around our ego. When we want to feel good about ourselves, so we can either be positive, move up, or we could be negative, knock someone else down. The pasuk says, "Im yishocha nachash b'lo lachash ve'nitron ebal halashon." If a snake bites without hissing, so what did God give him a tongue for? God gave him a tongue. Let him at least give us a warning. The Medrash says that when the world, in the time to come, all the animals are going to gather around the snake and say, hey, you, the lion eats, he consumes what he eats. The leopard eats, he consumes what he eats. You bite. You do. What are you killing humans for? You don't eat them. And the snake is going to turn back and say, and why do humans bite one another? Why do they say lashon hara about one another? They harm one another consistently. What do they gain from it? They don't eat anything. They don't consume the other person. And yet they kill him with their tongue. Chazal tell us that Lashon Hara was at the root of our exit from Gan Eden, was at the root of the downward spiral that the world went, and it's at the root of what we have to fix in order to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So our parsha is going to teach us about Yosef's Lashon Hara, Yosef speaking badly about his brothers, and what it caused. And we're also going to see that our parsha is an allusion to all the exiles, not just Yosef's going down to Egypt, which ultimately led us down to Egypt. So he's coming to his father and saying, you know, they're treating the sons of the Shvachos badly because their mothers were maids. And he's coming to his father and he says, Reuven, he's the one that did something improper with your wife Bilhah. And he ends up gaining from that. He gets the double portion that Reuven would have had. And he comes to his father and he says, you know, they're eating and I'm not sure that they're sacrificing properly before they eat. And so he is bringing the Batam Ra'ah. He is saying Lashon Hara about his brothers. And Lashon Hara kills the person who speaks and the person who listens and the person who it's said about. So Yosef's brothers are all going to suffer for what they're going to do to Yosef. And Yosef himself is definitely going to suffer for what he said. And his father Yaakov is also going to suffer for what's being said. He's going to have 22 years of spiritual death. He's going to have 22 years where he won't have God with him. The brothers are going to say, let's throw him into one of these pits. V'chisinu et damo. What do we have 50 of, David? 50 shavim. What are there? 50 what? What do we say there are 50? 50 gates of? Tuma. And what other 50 gates? Of elevation, of wisdom. And what other 50 things do we have when it comes to Sfirat HaOmer?
Yeah, 50 days after the second day.
So what do you guys say? You spired them and chassid them and each day with the Sfirat HaOmer? The different praises of Hashem, the different combinations, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what do we have 50 of? What did we just say? We have Tuma going down. We have going up.
50 years theoretically. 49.
Okay. So the brothers say, let's throw Yosef into the pit. V'chisinu et damo. And we'll cover up, what's the gematria of damo? 50. What do they do to their father? They seal him off. He's knocked down. God isn't with him the way he was beforehand. Yaakov Avinu, God doesn't tell him what's happening with Yosef. Yaakov Avinu is going to have 22 years now where he's going to be pretty much alone. He's in the land of Israel. He should have Nevuah, but he doesn't. So Yosef starts it by speaking badly about the brothers. Yeah.
Why does Yaakov get punished for what happened to
him? Oh. So Chazal tell us, Lolam al Yashane Adam Banav Bno Ben Abanim. Person should never treat a child different than another child. And I have to tell you a secret. When a child comes to his parent and says, which do you like best? Which of us children do you like best? So parents will often say, give me your hand. And they'll show them all the fingers and they'll say, which do you like best? This one might be better for opening a can of Pepsi with. And this one might be better for pointing with. And this one might be better for measuring with. But do you like one better than the other? Each one has different use, right? You don't like one better. That's how I am with my children. That's a nice answer. It's very good. But now I'm going to tell you the secret. Our nature is that we have children which we do go better with. That their nature does match our nature better. And then we have children that get on our nerves and drive us crazy. And that doesn't mean we'll necessarily love them more or less, but it's very easy to slide into that. Because naturally what happens is they're different. And naturally you have children which you get along better with and children you get along less well with. A person's responsibility is that his actions will be equal. A person can't necessarily control what's going on in his heart, but in his actions, he has to treat them all equally. Chazal say Yaakov erred in that. Yaakov treated Yosef differently. And had Yaakov not erred in that, then just like the first 190 years of the decree were fulfilled when we were traveling and Avram and Yitzhak were around, God decreed 400 years we'd be strangers. So they were strangers. They didn't own the land the first 190 years. The next 210 that we were in forced servitude and Jewish babies were murdered day in and day out, those 210 years didn't have to look that way. Chazal tells us they only looked that way because of the enmity that evolved within the brothers because of the way Yaakov treated Yosef differently. So Chazal put it on Yaakov's shoulders here. Yaakov and then the brothers and Yosef, everyone had a hand in it. So,
doesn't Egypt bear some of that responsibility for overstepping?
That's another aspect. The Egyptians, Hashem says in Zechariah, the Navi in Zechariah says, I decreed, and they went beyond the decree to do bad. So, that they're going to have to pay for. So the problem with the simple understanding here is that if Yosef was always telling bad about the brothers, that they were speaking badly about the brothers who were the maid's children, so why didn't those brothers speak up when Yosef was being sold? And that's why it seems that Yaakov told the maid's children that they should watch Yosef, they should take care of him, they should serve him. And they hated him for that. And the other brothers also hated him because they saw that he was given his own private servants, the other brothers. So, from Yaakov's perspective, he treated the wives all as equals. But when it came to this, he still gave Yosef preferential treatment. And Yosef was ben zkunim. Yaakov discovered him to be exceptionally bright, as we will see. He saves the world. That's what we'll see next week's parasha. It's not that he was so much, he was born when Yaakov was so much older. Yisachar and Zvulun were born 1 year earlier than Yosef. It's difficult to say Yosef was ben zkunim. He was the one born when Yaakov was an old man. They were all born when he was an old man. There's a difference of 1 year, 2 years, 3 years between him and the different children. But Yisachar and Zvulun were born when Yaakov was a year younger than this. So that's why it's easier to understand that he was just very smart. That's ben zkunim, a son that's like an old person. Others say that the custom was in those times that a person would set aside one kid and say, you're my old age home. You're my insurance policy. You take care of me when I become an old man. When all your brothers are getting married and going off, you stick around. You're taking care of me. So I don't know how it worked exactly, but they'd have this designation process where one kid was given the responsibility that he's taking care of the father. And Yosef got the responsibility. He was the ben zkunim. So Yosef is in a situation where his brothers hate him and they're jealous of him. And he tells them, I had a dream where your bundles surrounded me just like a king is surrounded. And they all bowed to me, and that's what's really going to happen. Because of bundles of wheat, because of food, all the brothers will bow to Yosef. That's a true dream what he had. Now the brothers shot themselves in the foot. Chazal tell us that Abaye and Rava, They were good friends. They learned together. They were both Kohanim. They both had the same dream quite a few times. And they went to an interpreter of dreams, Bar Hedyo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they said, interpret the dream to us. Abaye paid the money. Rava didn't. Chazal tell us, you want good service, pay. If someone's giving you medicine for free, you usually get what you pay for. A person should pay for what he's getting and he gets better service. So Abaye pays and the guy interprets the same dream for good. Rava doesn't pay, he takes the same dream, interprets it for bad, and the interpretation always came out true. One interpretation after the other. There's a whole long daf in the Gemara and Brachas that describes how this happened back and forth and back and forth. So the interpretation defines the dream. That's why a person shouldn't tell over his dreams. Chalma de lo mifresha ke igita de lo mikalia. A dream that isn't expressed is like a letter that wasn't read. You don't tell over your dreams, you don't have to worry about the interpretation. So a person shouldn't be telling people his dreams, he should keep them to himself.
Can you interpret for yourself?
It seems not. It says you should tell a good friend of yours that will give a good interpretation. But Tosa says that the interpretation, a person has to have the heavenly power to give an interpretation. It's not just anyone can give interpretation. But that's Tosa's understanding.
But in your mind, can you interpret
it? You should, in your mind, interpret it for good. Yes. So Yosef tells the brothers, what do? They shoot themselves in the foot. He said, your bundles will surround my bundle. What should they have said? Maybe we'll all be dancing at your wedding. They could have said a different interpretation. What did they say? Are you going to be king over us? Are you going to rule over us? What did they just do? They just interpreted the dream for him. They just interpreted that he's going to be king. They did that. They defined the dream. He comes and he says the next dream. He says, I have a dream and all the stars will surround me. And he kept telling them the dreams again and again. So they got upset. Why are you telling it to us again? We heard it already. He was behaving like a kid. So we're going to find in next week's Parsha that when Paro has the same thought given to him in a dream twice, Yosef tells him it's going to happen right away. That's why God gave you the same thought twice in a dream. Yosef has the same concept in a dream twice, but it's going to take 22 years before it happens. And the reason is, because, not 22, I'm sorry, 13. 13 years from now. He's 30 when he becomes king. So the difference is that Yosef saw both dreams on different nights, and Paro saw them both on the same night. When, for some reason, when you see the same dream or the same idea on the same night, then it means it's happening right away. Yosef dreams that the sun and the moon will bow to him. Chazal tell us that God came to Yoshua Binun. Yoshua came from Yosef. And God saw him with a book. And God said to him, that book, you have Mishneh Torah, the book of Dvarim, be strong with it. It should never leave you. You should always be reviewing Moshe Rabbeinu's review of the Torah, Mishneh Torah, Sefer Dvarim. So Yoshua took the book, Mishneh Torah, and showed it to the sun and the moon and said, now I want you guys to stop your song. I've been consistently saying this, now I want you guys to pause for me. I'm going to war, I need you, sun and moon, I need you to pause for me. And they didn't want to listen to him. And Yosef turned to them and said, you scoundrels, you unfaithful servants, you. You've already been bought by my great-great-grandfather. Yosef in his dream saw that you were all bowing to him, right? So you guys better listen up because you're my servants. You're mine. And when he said that, they said, okay, whatever you say, boss, whatever you say. So this dream seems to have had much more of an impact than just the dream that Yosef's going to be king. This dream gave potential to Yosef and his offsprings to the extent that Yeshua, by virtue of this dream, is able to stop the sun and the moon. Yosef tells his father the dream because the second dream hasn't yet been interpreted by anyone. And Yaakov falls for the same trap his children fell for. What does he tell Yosef? Do you really think me and your mother and your brothers will come and bow to you? Thanks, Dad. He just gave him the interpretation a second time. What was Yaakov upset at him for? Yaakov was upset, firstly, he said, why do you value this dream so much? Why are you telling everyone this dream? It means you think the dream has validity to it. And secondly, why are you dreaming this dream? Chazal tell us that dreams can come from one of a few things. Firstly, dreams can come from indigestion. If a person eats before he goes to sleep, that's going to cause him to have dreams. Those dreams don't have value. Those dreams stem from indigestion and they're going to cause a person to have bad thoughts and difficult dreams. But Chazal say that there was once an Amora that the king came to him and said to him, I want you to tell me what I'm going to dream about tonight. Meaning different people were tested with different things. One was said, interpret my dream. The other one said, tell me my dream. And this one was given a harder test than all of them. He was told, you tell me what I'm going to dream tonight. So he told him, you're going to dream tonight that this kingdom that you're having trouble with, you're going to have war with them, and you're going to win the war. So all day long the king was thinking about that. Wow, that's interesting. All day long he couldn't get that off his mind. And that night, that was the dream he had. Because Chazal tell us that what you think about during the day, what's really bothering a person deep down during the day, that's what's going to show up at night. So Yaakov turned to Yosef and he says, hey, why is this what you're busy with? Why is this what you're dreaming about at night? Ma halom hazeh asher chalamta. What is this? This is what you're thinking.
Because he thinks that Yosef was a servant.
Okay. So Chazal tell us, just like you can't have kernels without chaff, you can't have a granary without something that's solid that you can't really use. So too, you can't have a dream without some nonsense to it. Not every point in the dream is important. So Yosef also dreams about the sun and the moon when really his mother isn't around. The brothers go out to graze their sheep in Shechem. And Chazal tell us that there are dots on the word et. And this indicates to us that they really went to graze themselves. What does that mean, they went to graze themselves? Simple. They're going out there with the sheep. But really, what's going to happen because of the story? They're going to sell Yosef down to Egypt. Yosef's going to become viceroy of Egypt. In his position over there, he's going to amass food that's going to sustain the world, including his brothers. So they think they're going to take care of the sheep, when really they're going to take care of themselves. But really, this whole story is going to lead to the fact that they're all going to have food long term. They think they're taking the sheep out to eat, and really the sheep are taking them out to eat. They're the ones that are going to end up with the food because they went out there with the sheep. Imagine you have a building, and let's take a story that happened not so long ago. A plane went into a building, and it's this very big building. It's the 11th of September, and the building is going up in flames. And now a person gets a call, and he's in Atzala, and he's not far from there, and he's told there are people in there that need your help. Does he put himself into a question of danger? Let's take a different case. A person's riding a helicopter not far from there. He's giving tourists a guide of, he's showing them the, what's it called? The Liberty, Statue of Liberty. And he's riding his helicopter and he gets a phone call and he's told, we want you to land up there on top of the Twin Towers because it's burning. And the first building collapsed, and the second one's about to collapse. But we think you're going to make it. We think you have enough time. We think that if you land there, you'll be able to take a few people and take off. We're not sure, you know. Once the building comes down, there's suction. There's if you don't get out fast enough, you're gone. But we think you can make it. Do you mind landing there? So this is a question in halacha. And this is a question, I mean, soldiers have this also. Do I put myself into safek sakana because someone else is in Vadai Sakana? Do I put myself into questionable danger for someone else who is in certain danger? Yaakov felt his sons were in certain danger. His sons were out there in Shechem, and he knew there were people around waiting to pounce on the sons of Yaakov. They were in certain danger. If he would send the servant out there, so the kids would say, we're okay. Go tell dad we're okay. How many guys, their parents tell them, don't ride buses. We just heard it's dangerous to ride buses. I hope you guys are on top of the news. It is dangerous to ride buses now. No. I'm not telling you what to do. But, okay, just read some of the news. Okay.
I can't read anything.
A guy's parents tell him, don't ride buses. What does he do? He says, no, dad, it's okay. So Yaakov knows if he tries sending one of his servants, the kids are all going to say, it's okay. So Yaakov says, if I send Yosef, I have to wonder what's going to happen with those guys. But they also know that I have to wonder what's going to happen with them. When I send Yosef, I'm sending them a very clear message. I am so worried about you that it's worth it for me to send Yosef into a situation of danger to tell you, hey, come back, don't stick around there. So Yaakov calls Yosef and he says, son, I got to ask you a favor. And when your father begins with a sentence like that, you know it's going to cost you something. You know this isn't easy. So Yosef says, Hineni, whatever you want, Dad. And Yaakov says, you know, your brothers are out there in Shechem, and I'm worried about them. Please tell them to leave there. So Yosef goes, and Yaakov accompanies him part of the way. Yosef is going to go a long distance in order to honor his father. Yosef doesn't tell his father, they hate me. Yosef doesn't stop when he can't find them. He reaches the place where they're supposed to be and they're not there. He could have turned around, went back home and said, Dad, they weren't there. I don't know. It doesn't do that. It starts looking. Now the fact that they're so far away also gave them more confidence to do what they wanted with Yosef. You behave differently when you know your father might hear about it, when you're up the block from the house. And when you're out on vacation, out in a different state, you're somewhere else, no one knows what you're doing. So the brothers also, the fact that they were so far away, also gave them confidence to do what they did. He's going, and the one that's pulling the strings here is God. Chazal tell us that really, at this point, God should have made a world war. Egypt should have won the war, should have entered the land of Canaan, taken Yaakov hostage, put him in shackles, put his whole family in shackles, taken them down to Egypt, made them all slaves. We're hitting the point where in heaven we were supposed to become slaves. So it could have happened in one of two ways. God could have made it that Paro wins over the land of Canaan, and now they all go down in shackles. That's what could have happened. And instead God said, I'll do it in a way that's not so pleasant, but it's much easier for Yaakov. I'll bring him down to Egypt slowly. I'll get him settled in. And they'll evolve into slavery. So now this whole process is being guided by God. God wants this to happen now, so to speak. We're still going to pay the price for it. But God wants us down in Egypt. It's a punishment for all kinds of things, however we learned until now. But still it has to happen. And so God sends down an angel. And when Yosef doesn't find his brothers, so he meets an Ish. And this Ish was either Raphael, the gematria of Ish is Raphael, or the Malach Gabriel. And Yosef was To'e, mistaking his way around the field. What is To'e? To'e is a remez for our three exiles. Tough is 400, the 400 years we were in Egypt. Ayin is 70, the 70 years we were in Babylon. And Hay is 5, that's the 5,000 years that when they're up, we're hopefully going to get out of here. And they should be up as soon as possible. So Yosef is To'e Basadeh. He's erring around the field, and there's an illusion here between what's happening to Yosef and what's going to happen to the Jewish people. And he meets the angel and says, I'm looking for my brothers. And the angel answers him in a way that has dual meaning. And Yosef, on the surface, is going to understand one thing, but really there's another meaning that's hidden underneath. The angel tells him, they've traveled from that. What do you mean they've traveled from that? It says, they don't consider yourself an ach. Ach means connection, right? Le'achot means to connect. You're looking for your brothers, you're looking for your achim, the ones that are supposed to be connected from it to you. They've traveled from that. Nas'u, they have traveled mize. What is ze? Ze is gematria 12. They have left the concept of 12. God made a pact with Yaakov. There are going to be 12 tribes. They will never be extinct. And your brothers have decided, we don't need 12. There was Esav and Yaakov, one was bumped. There was Yishmael and Yitzchak, one was bumped. Now there are 12, one will be bumped. The brothers have decided, we don't need 12. We'll manage just fine with 11. So the angel's giving him illusions, he's giving him warnings, but Yosef obviously doesn't understand it. And so Yosef continues to find his brothers. And the brothers start thinking, how can we kill him without touching him directly? So they think, maybe we'll send the wild dogs at him. Maybe we'll shoot him with a bow and arrow from here. Let's do something and we won't kill him. But nothing works. And they say, you know what? If he makes it out of here, then he'll be king. Let's see. Let's see what will be with the dreams. We're gonna see what really happens with them. But they were also saying, and if he makes it out, then we know that the dreams are true. He's going to be king. Now, one of the things we see throughout the Torah and the Navi is that sometimes the exact actions which we do to try and stop a godly decree, that's what moves it forward. The Gemara says Shlomo once met the Malach HaMaves and he asked him, "Where are you headed?" So he said, "I want to get so and so, and I can only get him if he's not in this city." So Shlomo quickly sent his messengers and he sent word, "Tell the person right now I order him to get on the ship and get to that city." So the guy gets on the ship and he's riding, and when he gets to the gates of the city, he drops dead. So the Malach HaMaves turns to Shlomo and he says, "Thanks, buddy, you helped me out." So Shlomo says, "What do you mean?" So he says, "I had to kill him, but I was only allowed to kill him at the gates of that city. Once he would have entered, I couldn't have killed him, but I couldn't have killed him anywhere else either. I needed to get him there. So you helped me out. You got him there for me." Sometimes, he didn't give him the whole picture. We try very hard. And the exact actions which we do to stop something from happening, that's what makes it happen. So the brothers here say, "We'll take care of Yosef. We'll ensure he doesn't become king." And their actions are what's going to bring him, that's what's going to bring him to be king. The brothers, when Yosef comes to them, they tear off his clothing, they throw him into a pit. And that pit was empty, but inside there were snakes and scorpions that they didn't see from the top. Yosef gets thrown into that pit. Now this good-looking man is at the bottom of a pit with snakes and scorpions. They're not...
He's a what?
He's a good-looking man. They're not biting him, but they're hissing at him. So Yosef's at the bottom of this pit, and he's shivering. And he becomes pale. And he becomes more pale. And he becomes scared, and he has no way out. He begs. He pleads to the brothers. He yells out to them, "Don't do this, please." And they're not listening. We don't know that the Torah is very kind to us. The Torah doesn't go into these details. But later on, when the brothers are going to be faced with this evil Egyptian king that's making all these decrees against them, they start saying to one another, "Maybe this is because he was begging us. Our brother was begging us and we weren't listening." There we suddenly have an insight as to what really happened here. That when the brothers took him, this didn't happen 1, 2, 3, they gagged him, threw him into a pit. No, there was conversation here. There was wailing, there was yelling, there was a boy, a 17-year-old, calling to his brothers, "Don't do this to me," and the brothers threw him into the pit. And it's interesting, when we read the Torah, if we had more time, I wanted to take a few minutes. Maybe we'll do this, we'll make Michael happy. He's always been asking for this. Those of you who want, take out a chumash. We'll just look at the psukim for 2 minutes. We're supposed to have a little bit methodology. Michael always wants it. So we'll do it for just a quick 2 minutes. The Torah will sometimes, in 3 psukim, cover 500 years. And sometimes, in 3 psukim, it will focus on 1 minute. You can see an example of this by the Akedah. First, God tells Avram, "Go take your son." The next morning, Avram saddles the donkey, takes the lads and starts going. We have 3 days where we hear nothing. And the closer we get to that mountaintop, the more the Torah focuses in and tells us about each movement. When we finally hit that day, they see it from a distance. Avram tells the lads, "Do you see it? You guys stay here, we go up." He goes. He loads this over here and that over there. He takes this, Yitzchak takes that. They get up to the mountain. When they're at the top of the mountain, they build the altar. They start preparing it. He binds Yitzchak. He extends his hand. We're going down to seconds. Now Avram extends his hand to take the knife. Second by section description. In our parasha we have the same thing. Yosef is approaching. We don't know how many days he's been searching for his brothers. And finally, when he comes to them, so first we're going in a span of a half hour, an hour. They see him from a distance. They start thinking how they could kill him. We're holding Pasuk Yutes. Vayomeru Yishel Achiv, once at his brothers, Hinei ba lachalomot al hazeba. Behold, this dreamer is coming. Ve'ata lechu v'nargeu v'nashlichu b'achad haborot. Now we'll kill him and we'll throw him into one of the pits. What's one of the pits? Why do we have to go into all this detail? What did the Malach tell Yosef? Ki shamati umirim nelecha dotaina. I heard them saying they're going to Dotan. They're going to religiosity. They're searching for a religious reason to kill you, Yosef. They're searching, maybe they're going to have religious backing to spill your brother. Dotaina comes from the word dat, religion. What do they say about Yosef? Let's throw him into one of the pits. What's one of the pits? One of the Tariag mitzvos. V'nashvicheu l'chad haborot. Let's find one of those mitzvos and we'll find backing to spill his blood. Haborot gematria Tariag. They say, let's throw him in. When Izebel wants to murder Novos, she knows she can't just get up and kill a citizen. There'll be a rebellion. So what does she do? She sets up a court and finds witnesses and finds a way to say, oh, he's Chayv Misa. So she gets false witnesses. But when Shlomo wants to put his Rebbe Shimi ben Gera to death, so he looks. He says, Shimi is a Baal Machlokes. He's a man that spurs conflict within the Jewish people. My father told me to find a way to put him to death. I can't just put him to death. So he gives Shimi a challenge. And Shimi doesn't live up to the challenge. And finally he says, look, you didn't live up to it. Shimi says, yeah, but you told me not to go east and I went west. And Shlomo says, yeah, but I told you not to leave Jerusalem and you left Jerusalem. That's called rebelling against the king. Sometimes you could search for a reason to... Oh, so they said that they had reasons. We don't have time to go into that tonight, but they had religious reasons. They had religious backing. They said this. So the brothers say, let's throw him into one of the pits, and we will say, Chayaha a'achalatu, a bad animal ate him. Why all these details? Now, let us go and kill him. Notice how many words the pasuk uses to tell us about the murder here. And we will throw him into one of the pits. All these details, what importance is there? Let's just say the brothers thought to kill him, decided not to. When he came, they threw him into a pit. No, it doesn't say that. Details. And we will say, they're already thinking about how they're going to cover up. They don't just say, we found his cloak dirty. No. Chaya, ra'a, a bad animal, achalatu, ate him. V'nire, and we will see, ma'yiyu cholomotav, what will be with his dreams. Vaishma Ruven, we go into the details. Ruven heard. Everyone heard. No, Ruven registered differently. Vayatzileu mi yadam. We have introduction. He saved them. Vayomer, Ruven said. Notice how many words? Describing Ruven's one sentence. Yeah, because when there comes points where the Torah starts focusing in. Lo nakenu nafesh. We will not murder him. We will not kill his soul. Okay, I think we have to move forward, but... Yeah, when you're going through the parsha, sit and focus, and you'll see suddenly the pasuk says they sat down to eat bread. Why do I care that they sat down to eat bread? Or maybe the Torah is telling us that there was no compunctions here. They just threw their brother into a pit, and they're going to leave him for dead, and they could sit down and eat. We have a rule that a bezdin, a court that puts a person to death, may not eat the rest of that day. A court that rules, we're putting so-and-so to death. They execute a person, may not eat that day. The brothers just threw him into a pit to die, and they sit down to eat. And then the pasuk tells us, they lifted their eyes and they saw a band of Yishma'elim. Why'd they have to lift their eyes? Where were they looking? So simple reading is, they have to look to the distance. The Yishma'elim were from distance. But maybe their eyes were in the ground. They lifted their eyes and they saw a band of Yishma'elim coming from Gilad. Gilad is a place, traditionally the Gemara says, Gilad be-Gilad shchichi rotzchim. There are many murderers in Gilad. Gilad is the portion of Machir. We'll discuss it at a different time. Right.
Unintentional killers, that's what.
We have over here a seeming discrepancy in the psukim. The pasuk says that they looked up and they saw a band of Yishma'elim. They're coming down a trade route. There was a consistent trade route from Gilad with spices down to Egypt to sell the spices. So they know what these Yishma'elim are coming, and they know they're wealthy. But as the psukim continue, we have two other bands of people described. Midyanim and Middanim, without the yud. We know that the Pilegesh of Avraham had Midian and Midan and Yishbak and Shuach among her children. So there was Yishmael from Keturah or from Hagar. And then we also have Midian and Midan and other children. So you have Midianim and Midanim and Yishmaelim, all described in these verses. So here our sages have many, many different understandings going along the same lines in describing how Yosef was sold. The basic gist of things is that he was sold numerous times. And another aspect of the basic gist of things is that when they came down to Egypt, so Potiphar saw them and he said, to quote the Medrash, a German is usually found selling a black, but a black is not usually found selling a German. You Yishmaelim are all black. This slave is white. I don't understand how you came to be in possession of him and he's not in possession of you. That's not usually what happens here in Egypt. The slave trade is such, we don't get white slaves, certainly not owned by black men. So you must have just pounced on this guy and stolen him and you're coming here to sell him to me. Prove to me that he's really a slave. That someone won't show up in Egypt tomorrow and say he's not a slave, he never was a slave. These were just thieves who took him. Before I pay you, give me some documentation that he's a real slave. So here's where the Midrashim, the Mefarshim go different routes. We'll go with one route. There are many that go in similar routes. The brothers look up and they see from a distance the Ishmaelim. They start discussing, let's sell him to the Ishmaelim. As they're discussing it, so merchants who are Midianim show up and Yosef's still in the pit and they tell the Midianim, you want him? We have a kid, we just threw him into this pit. We don't know if he's dead or alive. You're getting a cat in the bag. You want him? You could have him? We all want a pair of shoes. The Midianim look to the distance and they see the Ishmaelim. And they know that the Ishmaelim will pay good money for such a slave. They know that the Ishmaelim have a lot of money. These are constant people on a trade route. They're always going and selling their spices down in Egypt. So they say, fine. They take him out of the pit and they see that the Ishmaelim are showing up. When the Ishmaelim come, the Midianim sell him to the Ishmaelim and the Ishmaelim sell him to the Midonim, and the Midonim sell him to Egypt. They come to Egypt, and Potiphar says, wait a second. How come you black people are selling this white man? That's not what usually happens. So they say, oh, wait, we'll go back. We'll call the Ishmaelim. They call the Ishmaelim in, and they say, Ishmaelim, you guys come testify to us that you bought him as a slave. And the Ishmaelim will testify, and that's why the sale to Potiphar is described in one place as being the sale from the Midianim to Potiphar, and in another place as being the sale from the Ishmaelim to Potiphar, because they both had a hand in it. Other explanations say that the Midianim were the merchants, the brokers. They brokered the deals. They brokered the deals with the Ishmaelim, they brokered the deals later on with Potiphar. That's why they were involved. Yeah?
And does it mean that even in those days, the racial difference between racial idea of white
that's what it seems like, yeah. It seems like from the time of Noah, the black was considered a sign of slavery. There were more slaves who were black than there were white. Yeah, that seems to have been the norm. That's what the Medrash says. So the brothers agree and they sell Yosef. And each one gets 20 silver coins. And the reason they don't get more money for him is because he's just spent quite a while down there with the scorpions and the snakes. He doesn't look his best. When he comes out, he's all shivering. He's got no color. He can barely stand. He's just been scared out of his wits. So when they look at him, they say, this guy, he's not worth much. So they don't get a good price for him. If he would have been himself, they could have gotten much more money for him. Reuven, we're going to see tomorrow night. I don't think we're going to finish the parsha tonight. Tomorrow night, Be'ez Hashem will finish it. When Yehuda admits that he was the one that impregnated Tamar, Reuven stands up and admits, I was the one who messed up the beds for my father. Yehuda is the first one to confess, and then Reuven confesses. But in our parsha, Reuven is still privately working on doing tshuva, and that's why he's not around when this whole conversation goes on. He's going off to work on his traits to attain complete tshuva, and that's something that's an evolvement. You see, Yehuda only confesses, the whole story with Yehuda happened about 13 years after this. So Reuven has been working for 13 years on doing tshuva, and when Yehuda is going to confess, Reuven will also confess. So the brothers send the garment to their father after they've pierced it. Vayeshalchu et ketonet apasim. The word shelach means sword, right? Mesu shelach is met v'shelach. He died with a sword in his hand. That's Mesu shelach's name. He died with a sword. He had a special sword he used to kill demons with, and they buried him with that sword. That's why it was called metu shelach. Met v'shelach. He died with the sword in his hand.
He killed the demons with a special sword.
Yes.
So you can be like a prophet that goes and kills the demons, the mazikin and all that, shaden.
Maybe we'll have a class on that. We had one already. Yeah.
Isn't it prohibited to bury a body with possessions of this world?
This was before the flood. This was Metushela.
Oh.
Back a long time.
I understand, if the
sword starts to exist. So they bring him the ktonet apasim. They bring him the garment, but they make sure those little stripes that he put on are still intact, that he sees them. As they're harming it, they want him to be able to recognize this garment. And they knew that if they'd just be silent, they could have just said, "He disappeared. We don't know. We never saw him." And then, like, Yaakov's going to have to wonder. Maybe he was kidnapped. Maybe who knows what happened to him. Why do they have to do this? Because they knew if they'd be quiet, then Yaakov will certainly suspect that they did something wrong. Yaakov knows what's going on between them. But they figure if they do it this way, then I'll think, okay, he died, you know, 12 children. He only lost one. Not the end of the world. And Yehuda tells him, "Haker no, please recognize, Haketonet binchahi, is this the garment of your son?" Notice the "your son," not "our brother." Yehuda said these words to his father. So later on in his life, when he's going to have the biggest shame in his life, he's going to get those same words. When Tamar sends him that package, she tells him, "Haker no," the same words. "Recognize, please, sir. Are these, do you know who owns these items? He's the one that fathered these children." There's a very interesting verse here. It says they came to comfort him, his sons and all his daughters. Who are all his daughters? He had one daughter as far as we know. So one understanding says that each child that was born had a twin sister with him, and that's who the Shvatim married. And we'll discuss that in a minute at greater length. Who did they all marry? So then he had daughters. But there's another understanding that says that a daughter-in-law is also called a daughter. And people think this is just for fun, but it's not. It's a question of respect. A son-in-law and a daughter-in-law, out of respect, should call their in-laws mom and dad. We find that there was a father-in-law who really wasn't behaving too well with his son-in-law. He tried to hit him with a spear once, and then a second time. And then he sent a bunch of soldiers to his house. They surrounded his house and they wanted to kill him. And then he spent 2 years chasing after him throughout the deserts trying to kill him. And at the culmination, where we have a point where the suspense is really sharp. He's chasing them, and he almost has them, and they're hiding in a cave. And then this man, his name is Shaul, if you haven't gotten it yet, King Saul, he goes into the cave, not knowing that they're hiding in the back of the cave, and he goes to the bathroom. And David and his two men, they sneak up, and they think, "We're going to kill him." And then David says, "No, we can't. He's anointed by God. God will kill him. We're not killing him. We're not doing this." But David says, "I have to show him that I could have done it. He's trying to kill me for so long. I have to show him I could have done it." So he sneaks up and he cuts off a piece of Shaul's cloak. And when Shaul leaves the cave, he's a distance, David walks out and calls out to him. And we think that when David calls out to him, he'd say, "Hey you! Hey mister! Hey sir! Hey king!" We wouldn't expect any special affinity between David and Shaul. Shaul's been trying to kill him for quite a while now. Shaul promised him one daughter and didn't give it to him. When time came, he was supposed to get that daughter. He gave her to someone else. Shaul hasn't been the greatest father-in-law on the surface. And what does David tell him? He says, "Ve'avi re'ei gam re'ei." My father, look. My father, please see. I have the corner of your coat here. I could have hurt you. At a time like this, we wouldn't expect David to call him Avi, my father. If ever there was a son-in-law that had room to have claims against his father-in-law, David was certainly in that position. And yet, he speaks to his father-in-law with respect and calls him Avi, my father. From here we derive that a son-in-law is supposed to talk to his father-in-law with respect, calling him father, calling his mother-in-law mother. And by the same token, parent-in-law is supposed to have such a fond relationship that he calls his daughters-in-law and his sons-in-law sons and daughters. And we find a very interesting application of this in the Gemara of Chanukah. The Gemara says that Rav Shizbi's father-in-law used to light many candles in honor of Shabbos. And Rav Chisda used to pass by his house often, and he saw that in honor of Shabbos there were many candles lighting. And Chazal tell us that when a person lights many candles in honor of Shabbos, he's blessed with children that are Talmidei Chachamim. If a person wears a nice garment to tzitzis, then God will honor him and he'll wear nice clothing. He'll merit to have nice clothing. So there are different things, different correlations that the Gemara gives us. So Rav Chisda sees that this man, we don't know who he was, he lights many candles, and Rav Chisda says, a great person will come from this house. And Chazal said, because he lit so many candles, he merited to have a son-in-law who was the great rabbi Rav Shizvi. So we see that this works even in blessings, that a son-in-law is like a son. So everyone tries to comfort him. And here we have a fascinating medrash. They come and they tell him his son is dead. So the medrash says, and this medrash is from Maseches Sofrim, it's quoted in the Machzor Vitri. I'm only telling you the source because it's going to sound like sorcery. So you should know it has a very strong source. The medrash says, what did Yaakov Avinu do when the children brought him the garment stained with blood? He didn't believe them at all. Why? Because he says, "Vayimen li'itnachem," he refused to be comforted. Because God created us in a way that for the dead, we accept comfort and we're willing to forget. And if someone isn't really dead, if he's really alive, then God made it that we don't really accept comfort. What did Yaakov do? He went among the mountains and he quarried out 12 stones and stood them up in a row. And on each stone, he wrote the name of a shevet, of one of the Shvatim, and the name of its mazel, the name of its constellations in the zodiac, and the name of his month. So on one stone he would write Reuven Tle Nisan, Shimon Shor Iyar. And that's how he went writing on each of the 12 stones the name of the sun and the name of the mazel and the name of the month. And then he laid down all the stones and he said, I command upon you, you should all stand in honor of Reuven. The stones remained flat. I command upon you, you should all stand in honor of Shimon. They all remained flat. And when he said, I command upon you, he went shevet by shevet. When he got up to Yosef, they all stood and bowed before the stone of Yosef's. He still wasn't clear that Yosef was alive. He went and made bundles of wheat and wrote on each bundle a name of the shevet and their mazel and their month. And then he said, I command upon you, bow to Levi. Levi's going to wear the Urim V'Tumim. They didn't bow. I command upon you bundles. You should all bow to the bundle of Yehuda. He's going to be king among Israel. They didn't bow. And when he said the name of Yosef, all the bundles stood up and bowed to Yosef's bundle. And still, he wasn't convinced until he verified the name of the Mishmaros, that El Yoshiv, the Mishmar, the watching that corresponds to Yosef, that watching would end up having the name El Yoshiv, God will return, and El Kono, that God caused him to be bought by Potiphar, and that's why Yosef was brought down to Mitzrayim and was bought by Potiphar. How any of this works, I don't know. So Yosef is purchased by the chief executioner who wants him for Mishkav Zohar. He purchased Yosef with one thought only. In Egypt, people are one-track minded. The men and the women. The Torah tells us, don't behave like the Egyptians. It means that we're prohibited to have lesbian activity. Even the women, they were high on this. The men, the women, men were going with men were going with women, women were going with women. You couldn't know who was whose son. So Potiphar, when he purchases Yosef, he has one thought. And God doesn't want that to happen to Yosef. So God sends Gavriel, who castrates Potiphar. And from that day on, Potiphar can't really do anything. So Potiphar is castrated, and his wife is there without a husband, and she has a very good-looking young man in her house. Chazal tell us that a person has to learn from Potiphar. We're not supposed to appoint someone responsible in our home. Sometimes a person wants to hire a butler. Ho, run the house. Let me deal with my business. Ho, run the house. Chazal say no. That's a formula for trouble. We see from Yosef, Potiphar had a great tzaddik in his house, and still look what happened. Certainly all of us have to learn from that. The Torah now is going to focus on Yehuda and leap forward for 13 years. And during these 13 years, we know Yosef is also evolving. He's in Potiphar's house, and then he's in jail, and then he becomes king. But the Torah stops and focuses in, and the Torah wants to have the story of Yehuda with Tamar in juxtaposition with the story of Yosef and Potiphar. We have two stories that have similarities, and the Torah wants them one next to the other. So Yehuda is demoted. The brothers see how their father reacted, and they hold Yehuda accountable. Yehuda goes and marries a woman, we don't know her name, but we know that her father was Bat Ish Kenani Ushmo Shua. His name was Shua. So he was a merchant. Now the question is, who did all the Shvatim marry? So one midrash says that each Shevet had a twin sister, and then the Shvatim are not allowed to marry their own sister, so they'll marry a sister who only shares a father but not a mother. A Noahite, at least in those times, could do that. So this goes with the understanding that they were careful, like Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov were careful not to marry Canaanite women. They might have married Mitzri women, Ammoni women, Moabi women, Yishmaeli women, Keturah women, but not Canaanite women. The Canaanite were slaves, the Canaanite had bad traits, they weren't supposed to be married into them. So we have different understandings among our sages. One understanding says they did marry Canaanite women. Rav Nechemia says in the Medrash, that's what they did. And Rashi quotes this in Parashas Vayechi. When Yaakov passed away, he told his children, carry me up to Egypt, but you carry me, not the grandchildren. Because the grandchildren have Canaanite women blood in them. I don't want them carrying my bed. Rashi quotes this opinion later on. So the accepted opinion, though, the more known opinion, is that they did not marry the Canaanite women. And the Ibn Ezra even goes so far as to say that the Torah is telling us that Yehuda, his children, look how evil they were, because he married a Canaanite woman. So we're going with the understanding that Kanani means a merchant. But Kanani literally means a Kanani. So the Ibn Ezra says, yeah, that's what the Torah is telling us. He married a Kanani woman and look what happened to his kids. So his first son, he names Er. The second son, she names Onan. Onan means sorrow. Why does she name a child sorrow? So it seems that it was accepted in those times that women would name the child after the birthing experience. So, let's finish one thing and get on to the next thing.
Why is the name Er?
In one second. When a woman had a difficult birth, so the child would get named like that. There was a famous man named Yavetz, and Yavetz, who was a big Talmud Chacham, was named after Etziv, sorrow. His mother had a very difficult birthing experience. The name Miriam, you guys can figure out where that comes from. That's because the Chazal tells us at that time, the Shiabud, the work in Egypt, became exceptionally bitter. So Onan was called Onan, sorrow. The first son was called Er, like Orirat Gvuratcha, let your braveness be aroused. Er means to arouse. Now, we find that he named the first son, she named the second son, and then she gave birth, and he was in Chziv, and she named the third son. So who was in Chziv? So one understanding says, the baby was in Chziv. She gave birth in the place called Chziv. Chziv means to lie, to be unreliable. And that's why she called him Sheila, which also means unreliable. But there's another understanding that says that that was how they used to divide it, and that's how people do today also. One partner would name the first child, the other partner would name the second child, and then back and forth. So Yehuda named the first one Er. She named the second one Onan. Now it was his turn, but he was out on business. He was in Chaziv. Yehuda wasn't around. So she named the third one, she named him Sheila. But the Ramban doesn't like that shot.
What means Sheila? Unreliable.
Sheila is like lo tashle oti. When Elisha promises the woman a child, she says, don't deceive me. Give me something that I can rely on. Give me a child that's reliable. So Sheila is like hashlaya, le'ashlot, to deceive, to be unreliable. Don't the targum of lo tashle oti is lo techadev pitgamach ba'amatach. Techadev is like chazav. Don't lie in your wording to me. And chaziv literally means lie. Er marries his wife, and the Torah stresses that Er dies because of his own sin. The Torah is telling us, do not think Yehuda just caused his father such sorrow by selling his son. Maybe this is a punishment to Yehuda. Yehuda had every reason to think, my son died, you know why? Because I just made my father lose a kid. So that's why I lost the kid. No. The Torah is telling us, no. This child died because of his own sin. He was sinful, so he died. And the same thing with Onan. Yehuda comes to Onan and he says, I want you to do Yibum, to marry your brother's dead wife, your deceased brother's wife. We don't find this custom earlier. One understanding is that this was accepted among the world back then. And one understanding says, no, Yehuda initiated this custom in the world, Yibum. So, the brother agrees and he says, I'm scared the child, he says to himself, the child won't be considered my child. This can only be understood with deep Kabbalistic understandings. So those of you who have them know the answer here. I who don't know how all this works. That child dies and he tells her, I want you to stay in mourning until it's time for you to marry. And he says, why? Because Yehuda said to himself, maybe the third child will die like the first two. We have a machlokas in all of Shas. How do you have a chazakah? We know chazakah is usually with three. This you guys have to know. Chazakah ordinarily is with three. We say if an ox gored three times, chazakah that he's a goring ox. With things that have to do with monetary issues, we say three times proves it. But that's only with monetary issues. There are two opinions. Do two times make a chazakah or three times? If a woman gets married, and after 10 years she has no children, and then she gets divorced and marries a second person, and another 10 years and doesn't have children, so we say twice is enough to prove she can't have kids. When it comes to issues of sakana, issues of marriage, there we say two proves it. We go with the opinion of Rebbe that two makes a chazakah. So if a woman had one child and they did a bris milah and God forbid that child died, and they have a second child and God forbid that child dies, we don't do a third and say, well, three proves it. If a woman has a sister who had a child that they did a bris milah and the child died, and she has a different sister and that child they did a bris milah and the child died, we say two proves it. When it comes to issues of sakana, issues of marriage, so then very often, again, we have to understand what's the driving force in each point, but like on, okay, whatever, we won't go into all details, but there we say two proves it. So by the same token here, what happened? Yehuda said, she married my first son, he died. She married my second son, he died. Two proves it. Two makes a chazakah. I'm not giving her the third. Yeah?
When he go to his sons and say, hey guys, you doing everything correctly? So they're doing something incorrectly.
They're dead. How's he going to go to them?
I mean, for his first son, maybe he didn't know. But his second son, he should have said to him, hey son, you doing everything like you were supposed to?
Why should he say that? People die. I mean, why? Think about it. He only after the second one does he suddenly see a pattern. The first one died, he died. Only after the second one does he see a pattern, and then there's no one to ask.
Okay.
Right? But, here, so here there's a difference between the Rishonim. Some Rishonim say, like you, that it's impossible that his sons were so sinful and he didn't know about it. This is something to think about. People today, unfortunately, think that birth control is permissible. And it's not so simple. There are dire circumstances where one might have to permit birth control. If a woman's life is going to be in danger, that if she becomes pregnant, so then there are certain forms of birth control that can be permissible. But a person has to go to his local Orthodox rabbi and verify. We see here, they did birth control. That's what these two sons did. And God looked at it and said, even though they were minors, they weren't yet bar mitzvah, they both got the death penalty for it. So people can't take for granted that birth control is permissible. There are different forms of birth control, and even the forms that are permissible are only going to be permissible when it's under the guidance of a rabbi in specific instances. And even then, the way that a rabbi will usually give permission to use birth control is he'll say, okay, for this month you guys can use birth control, let's talk next month. This is an issue that's so stringent that you won't get a blanket permission. A responsible rabbi is not going to say, oh, this birth control is allowed. It's not. First of all, we have a responsibility, pru urvu. And beyond pru urvu, we have a responsibility to bring children to the world beyond pru urvu. We're going to pick up Be'ezrat Hashem tomorrow with the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and we'll finish the parasha Be'ezrat Hashem. Be'ezrat Hashem tomorrow we will